Okay, so we have an outstanding panel of contributors to this question of what is quantum gravity, and I was asked to give a few opening remarks just to get us started. So as you've already heard, one of the dramatic developments in the subject is that we now know, at least in certain toy models, that space-time itself has constituents that we can identify, that it consists of strongly interacting quantum mechanical degrees of freedom, living in fewer dimensions. And this is precise in toy models and extends, at least in an approximate way, to more realistic situations, such as accelerating universes, a subject which has had infusion of both data and theoretical developments in terms of the very active area now of the microscopic construction and formulation of accelerating cosmologies. Now, both these aspects of the subject have had a huge infusion of progress from KITP workshops. In particular, the first aspect, including the ADS-CFT correspondence, was hashed out. The further developments after the original idea were hashed out in a big way at the string theory workshop at the ITP in 98. And this more recent subject of string vacuum constructions and moduli fixing and such were hashed out in the later KITP M theory workshop, as well as these other examples. So personally, I would also like to add my congratulations on the anniversary of the ITP. It's, for me, been a spectacular place to work, and a large fraction of my favorite projects have occurred in this place with the people here. So despite all this progress, as you've also heard, there are huge open questions in the subject. For example, we don't really understand how to compute quantum mechanical transition probabilities involving space-time itself. There are competing proposals that disagree by 120 orders of magnitude in the exponent. We really don't have a prediction of the number of dimensions or the role of symmetries. This kind of question came up just recently. And we don't know how predictive the whole thing is going to end up being, despite its many successes. It could be a framework like quantum field theory, which is a consistent description of nature when it applies, but within which we build more specific models. Or it could be something which eventually leads to a unique low energy, late time, long distance physics. Or it could be something in between. And you can see by my number of question marks where my prejudice lies in that spectrum of possibilities. So with that, let's turn to our first panelist. Could Professor Ashikar come up and join us here?
I think, as we heard from several speakers, there has been a lot in the field of quantum gravity over the last 20 years or so, but it's still very much an open question. And when questions are open issues like that, it is often useful to step back a few decades and see what are the questions that people were asking for a very long time, predating the currently active approaches, and that were considered to be fundamental. So I'd like to start with just a list of such questions. And of course, because of time limitations, can't go into too many of them. One of the questions that came up often was, is continuum only an approximation? If so, what is the true structure of space-time at scale? I mean, it could be an emergent phenomenon. How does this really happen? The associated question is really, if in fact the continuum is an approximation, then how does classical general relativity, which is successful at large scales, very, very successful, how does that emerge? And how does all of low-energy physics emerge? In a sense, these questions are like condensed matter physics questions, because if one had a full theory, then one would have the exact Hamiltonian, and from there, how do all these things, such as the beeping here, how does it all emerge as a prediction? The second sort of important question that has been with us for a long time is, what is the true nature of the Big Bang singularity? The classical general relativity predicts that there is actually infinite curvature there. Therefore, classical physics just stops there. We all believe that that is just a limitation of the theory. So if we had a better theory, well, does that theory resolve the Big Bang singularity, and what does it have to say about true nature of quantum physics around there. There are all sorts of very fascinating questions about properties of quantum black holes, which are ramifications on very basic notions about quantum mechanics, for example, that we have. There is a whole bunch of questions which have to do with adequacy of quantum mechanics to describe quantum gravity, which were discussed in the panel yesterday. So the question for the panel was, for this panel was, what is quantum gravity? And my own view is that it should be a theory which unifies the principles of general relativity and quantum physics, and which is internally coherent, and which is capable of answering such questions, not only the internal questions that might arise from, but the questions which have been with us for a very, very long time. Steve Shankar, who communicated with us about this program, about this particular panel, asked us to tell you about various lines of inquiries in this particular subject. And what I would like to tell you about today is just this one line of inquiry, which goes under the name of loop quantum gravity. So this is I heard a lot of things about string theory. This is a complementary approach. It's a different approach. And here the viewpoint is very much that the fundamental description should be background dependent. Einstein taught us via general relativity that there is no background arena on which physics happens. Geometry is an actor as well as matter fields, and therefore in a quantum theory of gravity, geometry and matter should both be born quantum mechanically. And what we therefore need is really a non-perturbative approach which will tell us what replaces classical space-time. Now, replacing classical space-time is rather hard, and unfortunately, however, we have been able to make some progress, and this progress occurred due to about the work of over 24 groups in the mid-90s, and the program of loop quantum gravity is really on a specific theory of quantum Riemannian geometry. What people did here was to go to classical general relativity and carry out a certain non-perturbative quantization to find this specific theory. In this theory, the fundamental excitations of geometry are one-dimensional, so heuristically it looks like a polymer, and the continuum of approximation arises only as an approximation. My favorite analogy is a fabric. If you look at a fabric, it is really woven by one-dimensional threads, yet for all practical purposes, it has a feel of two-dimensional continuum. So the idea is that the same thing happens in the quantum theory. And then this leads to various remarks, various relations about the exact nature of quantization of geometry. It has a bunch of ramifications, and since the time is running out, I will just tell you about one of them. And this has to do with the resolution of the Big Bang singularity. So what we can do is, we can take this quantum theory of geometry, go to the arena of quantum cosmology, and see if in fact, because of quantum effects of geometry, physics is modified in the near singularity. And what one finds in detail is that indeed is the case. The Big Bang singularity is actually resolved. And one can actually take, so to say, the wave function of the universe in quantum cosmology and actually evolve it back right through the Big Bang. This has very interesting ramifications on what happens somewhat later, somewhat after Big Bang, somewhat after the Planck regime. One can still talk about effective classical equations, but they are not Einstein equations. They are corrections to Einstein equations, and these corrections have implications, for example, on the chaotic inflationary scenario. Chaotic inflationary scenario becomes much more plausible. There are other things about black holes, but I don't have time to tell you about that. So I just want to summarize and say that what loop quantum gravity is, it is an ongoing program. It has begun to answer some of these long-standing questions that I began with. It offers a fresh perspective. It's different from string theory, but in many ways it's complementary to string theory. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next speaker will be Juan Malacena.
Where's the pointer? Is this the pointer? Okay, well, happy birthday, ITT. So one of the things we learned recently in string theory is that quantum field theories are equal to gravity, quantum gravity in spaces which have boundaries. So the idea is that if we have a quantum field theory defined on some space, denoted here by this red circle, that's the same as a gravity theory in the interior of the spacetime. Now, the type of gravity theories are quantum gravity theories, such as string theory. Now, the theories at the boundary are local quantum field theories, such as, for example, Young-Mills theory, or QCD. Now, typically, if we want here the radius of curvature to be large in Planck units, we'll need to take the number of colors to be extremely large. So number of, this is a Young-Mills theory, so it's a version of QCD, where the number of colors goes to infinity. If the radius of the space is much bigger than the Planck scale. So typically you get that the radius of the space goes like some positive power of the number of colors. It depends a little bit on the dimension, and so on. Now, it's been known that in Young-Mills theory, when the number of colors is large, the gluons interact with each other and form strings. Now, these strings are really the strings of quantum gravity, the strings of string theory, and these strings really move in this higher dimensional spacetime. So and whenever gravity is a good approximation here in the interior, the field theory is strongly coupled. So this is an example where strong interactions in a quantum system give rise to an effective theory, which is this effective theory that lives in the interior, which is a quantum gravity theory. So space-time is an emergent phenomenon of this quantum field theory. So the basic, this transparency, I'm just trying to explain one way of understanding how this extra dimension appears. Because we start with a theory, let's say, in four space-time dimensions, for example, and we are getting one more spatial dimension, which is the dimension orthogonal to the boundary. And so the basic reason this arises is the following. So here we have some theory with some interactions, and there are, let's say, some quasi-particles. And one important property is that in many examples, this theory, let's say, has some scaling symmetry. So if we have quasi-particles of some size, we have them then in all sizes. So we can take a quasi-particle of one size, then make a scale transformation. So these quasi-particles come in families of different sizes. So in order to specify the, let's say, coordinates of the quasi-particle, we not only have to give the position in the boundary, but you also have to give its size. And from the interior point of view, the size of the of this quasi-particle corresponds to the position of a particle in the interior. So these quasi-particles of different sizes correspond to the same particle in the interior, but at different distance from the boundary. And this is basically the basic physical mechanism by which you really grow this extra dimension. So the interactions of these quasi-particles are better described in terms of the theory of gravity in one more dimension. In this theory of gravity, it's a warped geometry with gravitational potential that pushes everything to the interior. So as you try to take a particle to the boundary, the energy increases. And that's related to the fact that when you make the size of some object, its energy increases in the quantum field theory. Now, this has led to concrete descriptions of black holes. So black holes are just nothing more than thermal states in the boundary theory. So a black hole in the interior is basically similar to a quark gluon plasma in the Young-Mills theory. And the entropy is just the number of microstates of the gluons. So we have a gas of gluons that are interacting strongly. You just compute the entropy as the number of microstates, and that's the entropy of the black hole. So one of the interesting consequences is that the evolution is unitary, so there is no information loss. So we can describe, in principle, the formation and evaporation of a black hole in a way that is consistent with quantum mechanics. So this way of viewing quantum gravity is compatible with just the ordinary principles of quantum mechanics. And in terms of the future, I think something that we would like really to understand is whether the time direction can also be emergent. And this would be, I think, very important or very useful for describing cosmology. So in what I described before, the emergent direction was mostly, well, it was a space-like direction. And it would be nice if we could have an emergent time direction because in this way we could probably, once we understood it, we would be able to describe space-like singularities, so cosmological singularities. So the idea is that maybe there is a description of the theory where we are interested in computing the wave function of the universe in the future, and we would compute that by computing the partition function of some suitable Euclidean field theory on the future boundary of space-time, and this would presumably be the exact description that takes into account all the effects that are happening in the singularity. Of course, this is just a dream. We don't know how to do this yet, but maybe something we might achieve in the next 25 years. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, we can clap for Juan because he didn't take his full time. Next speaker is Lenny Susskind.
Congratulations, David. David and I have been friends for 40 years now. Realize that? 40 years. I was thinking on the way over here, coming down here, how I would help celebrate this event. And I thought to myself, gee, what should I do to show David how much I admire him and so forth? And I decided that in honor of David, I would not use the term anthropic principle for the next 6 minutes. And Frank, where's Frank? Oh, is Frank leave? Was he feeling ill? Was he feeling sick? I noticed yesterday he didn't look so good. I thought maybe his head looked a little swollen. Anyway. How many, have I used my 5 minutes yet? What's that? This is hopeless. There's no way to do this. What I've decided to do is to just show you my transparencies and let you figure them out yourself. So my first one is a summary of the standard model. I hope everybody knows what a Rube Goldberg machine is. Oh, whoa. I have the same problem that, oh, there it is. Okay, is that right? No. Oh, I see. I have to stand upside down. Okay, that's the standard model for you. It's a clumsy, overly complex, confusing thing that has no simplicity, no elegance, but it works. It works. How does it work? Among other things, it works in that it provides the basis for chemistry, nuclear physics, biology, you and me. I didn't say the word. Now, I have a quick summary also of cosmology. Here it is. Cosmology. Ah, damn it. Cosmology, all of it, is a roll from a large vacuum energy, a relatively large vacuum energy, to a small vacuum energy, and at both ends, it's incredibly fine-tuned. The only good things to say about these fine-tunings, if they weren't there, we wouldn't be here. Third transparency. Now, let's see if I can get this right. Yeah. Third transparency comes from string theory. What we've been discovering about string theory over the last X number of years is that it's very complicated. It has a huge number of vacuums. And more recently, we've been discussing non-supersymmetric vacuums. Again, the space of them, which is now called the landscape, appears to be exceedingly complicated. Of course, we don't know this yet, but we seem to be finding that it's extremely complicated, with something possibly like 10 to the 500 vacuums, such that the parameters of the theory, such that the vacuum energies and cosmological constants, all the other constants of nature, seem to form what we call a discretuum, that's a play on the word continuum, that they're so dense that they almost form a continuum. Why is this? The reason is because string theory is very complicated. That's the reason. It doesn't matter which way you show this one. For the non-experts, that's a Calabi-Yau manifold, I am told. Some projection of it. Right, they're very complicated. They have many, many parts, very, very many moduli, coordinates, and so forth. And whenever a configuration space has hundreds of degrees of freedom, it's likely that the number of ground states or metastable ground states will be exponential in that. It's true in molecular physics, that's why protein folding is so hard, and it's true probably in string theory, just it's much more than enough. All right, so what picks among all these vacuums? What picks among all these vacuums is a concept that string theorists have invented, which is called the vacuum selection principle. But the vacuum selection principle, like the Holy Grail and the Loch Ness Monster, has never been seen. It has never been seen by human beings, and some of us suspect it doesn't exist, that there is no vacuum selection principle, but instead something else replaces it. Every vacuum occurs. Eternal inflation, bubble nucleation of metastable vacuums producing more metastable vacuums, inside other vacuums, until you simply populate this entire landscape. Someplace in the universe, or someplace in the megaverse, or whatever it's called, everything occurs. That's the basic layout of what's called the landscape approach to physics. Is it correct or isn't it correct? Well, let me formulate it as two questions. The first question, and in my own opinion, incidentally, is that all of cosmology and particle physics and string theory turn on these particular questions. The first is simply, does this landscape really exist? We certainly haven't understood it with the same level of precision that we understand other vacuums of string theory. So this is probably an answerable question. Mathematical physicists like Shamit Kashru and our friends at Stanford, Eva, Michael Douglas, and others are examining this question, and I think in time we will definitely know the answer. Does it exist or doesn't it exist? The second question appears harder to me, whether this concept of eternal inflation, bubble nucleation, can really be made crystal clear in the context of, let's say, string theory. I'm finished. That's it. I was going to make some predictions, but I won't make them. All right. The prediction is the answer to the questions will be yes. And the other prediction is that in time, string theorists, including Ed Witten, will eventually begin to see this as a good thing and begin to realize this is the greatest strength of their own theory. Thank you. What?
Thank you very much, Lenny. Our next speaker is Professor Atift.
Okay, so I think I'm one of the few speakers who made a prediction that's already been verified during the meeting, which was that my prediction was that when Lenny said he only needed 45 seconds, that he would use a full 6 minutes. Anyway, my talk will for the rest mostly be orthogonal to most others, just because very interesting things have already been said about quantum gravity. My talk yesterday was about deterministic theories, and okay, this is another prediction which won't be verified very soon, but as I yesterday explained, I have some suspicion and also some arguments about believing that actually determinism will sooner or later come back in physics. And we just heard from Ed Witten, who mentioned the theorem. The theorem is that all the interesting ideas will soon be, which were launched as a criticism against string theory, will soon be absorbed by string theory. And so my prediction is that string theory will eventually also consider determinism as an important ingredient in the theories. So what I mentioned was that you have a deterministic theory with information loss, which means that if you start out with very different configurations, so if you start out with different states, they might, as time evolves, converge to become the same state, and these different possible sets of states, which all eventually, as time goes here to the right, when they emerge to become the same state, then I call these equivalence classes. They are fundamentally indistinguishable because later they'll become identical, so you can never tell anymore from which of those states the universe started. these equivalence classes are then to be identified as the quantum states or a basis of a Hilbert space. And what I did not have time to say yesterday, that's why I just repeated here, is that these equivalence classes might well be the deeper reason why we see gauge invariance, in fact, gauge equivalence classes in this world. So when we talk about the gauge theory, we have many different ways of describing the same state, and these different ways might actually correspond to different elements inside such a class, which are fundamentally indistinguishable for observation, just like gauge inequivalent states are indistinguishable from observation. If this is true, and if what I also think to be true, that these equivalence classes are very large, there's an enormous amount of information loss, classically say, in a black hole, that predicts that the gauge groups will be very large. So one possible other prediction is that maybe not yet in LHC, but in the more distant further unifications of field theories, that there will be very large gauge groups. Well, this actually is also agreed about in string theory. The equivalence classes, the gauge equivalence classes in string theory are tremendous because they are generated by the coordinate invariants on the string worldsheets, which are much, much bigger than the gauge transformation groups of ordinary grand unified theories. So the fact that the gauge group will be large is something which one can expect. So that answers actually not the question what is quantum gravity, that may answer the question what is gauge invariance, which may be also an interesting question to ask. But okay, we are here perhaps to say a bit more about what is quantum gravity. Now, whenever I talk to string theory, I discover every time again how tremendously clever string theory is. In this particular case, how tremendously clever they are in ducking the question about the horizon of a black hole. And thank you. So what we really want to understand is how it can be that in Drindler space, ingoing particles somehow turn to outgoing particles. We know a black hole has a finite number of states. That's all sorts of string theory tells us. A finite number of states so that everything you throw in should eventually come back out, but it doesn't seem to be in Drindler space. Unless you introduce some region here, which I used to call a brick wall, and inside that region here, something becomes fundamentally unobservable. And these fields inside are not there for some reason. Well, maybe a different way of saying is that these fields inside, whatever they are, if you modify these fields, you're not modifying the outside state. So modifying these fields inside are gauge transformations. So perhaps what are ordinary fields in the bulk will turn into gauge transformations in this inside region. That sounds very mysterious, thank you, very mysterious until you reach the point of doing what actually Stephen Hawking did, which is go to Euclidean space. In Euclidean space, the Rindler space, instead of becoming hyperbolic, becomes just a circle. And then you see that apparently there is a brick wall in Euclidean space, is just a circle, and inside the circle, it's just gauge invariance. So this suggests that space and time somehow is going to be replaced by a lattice where the relevant field degrees of freedom are only on the edges of, or on the points of the lattice, or perhaps on the links of the lattice, but the bulk region inside is no longer physically distinguishable. This is very much the situation you seem to be getting in a non-commutative theory. So it seems that space-time somehow turns from a continuum into indeed, let's use Lenny's words, discretuum. Space-time seems to be coming such that the degrees of freedom are much less dense than in a strict continuum. Inside these regions, it seems to be that we have only gauge transformations. And that means that we're going to have some sort of hybrid of topological field theory and ordinary 3+1 dimensional field theory. Topological field theory has it that all degrees of freedom are on the boundary. I like to see something in between. All degrees of freedom are not on the boundary, but have to be spread in a kind of lattice inside the space-time continuum, but in between the bulk region of the lattice, the degrees of freedom are unphysical, somehow have to be transformed into unphysical, unobservable elements of the theory, which are just gauge transformations. You can also say, thank you, you can also say as you, if you insist on describing space and time as a continuum, that that's a kind of, well, the information loss implies that two high frequency modes are rapidly disappearing from the spectrum because of some sort of dissipation. So frequencies higher than the frequency of these letters will simply disappear. So this is a kind of picture that comes out that, to my mind, seems to be making a lot of sense. So from black holes, we arrive at a picture of space-time where we can possibly understand why we today find an effective quantum theory. It looks like quantum mechanical, but actually it is it could be based, starting from a deterministic theory, you might end up with a very coherent picture. And what I like about it is that it might possibly restore some notion of locality, which, as we learned from most string theorists, is completely not there in that present view. I think we have to restore some notion of locality just to get logical coherence in all these theories. But I should stop here, as I've been told by the chair of this session. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And our last but not least, we have Kamran Vatha.
Okay, thanks for the invitation and congratulations to KITP and to Dave. I'm going to talk about some aspects of string theory which has recently emerged and in line with trying to swallow up other kinds of fields. Quantum foam is one of them, and I'm going to talk about the connection between string theory and quantum foam. So as we know, moving from Newtonian mechanics to Einstein's theory, we are replacing flat space with curved space-time. And the quantum theory of gravity has been rather difficult to formulate due to the ultraviolet divergences, and as Ed reviewed, string theory has emerged as a prime candidate to resolve these problems, and we have a well-defined perturbative formulation of quantum gravity in the context of string theory. And we have these beautiful diagrams of string theory connecting up and moving and joining, so it's a very pretty picture of how this happens, and we have a nice geometric formulation of quantum theory of gravity, at least perturbatively. And it's also mathematically very rich, but it doesn't answer one important question that was set a long time ago by Wheeler, that simple analysis of quantum theory mixed up with gravity suggests that something is happening very widely at the Planck scale of order of 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. And the observation that he made was that we expect that at the Planck scale, the space will look very, very non-smooth and very foamy, and these fluctuations of topology and geometry at different scales should happen if you just do a back of an envelope calculation in the context of mixing quantum theory with gravity. And these kind of fluctuations would inevitably change topologies because you would pass through singularities and you have to say what happens after that. So you have to end up with a big, big configuration space of different topologies and geometries which looks like a mess. And that's what naive description of quantum gravity would suggest. So space and time should look like some kind of a quantum foam at the Planck scale has been the idea. And so we expect that all quantum theory of gravity to somehow have some notion of this sum over these foams, at least in the Euclidean formulation where you rotate the time to imaginary time, you expect some kind of a statistical mechanical ensemble of which would mean to be corresponding in one-to-one to some kind of fluctuations, geometries of topologies. So string theory, when it's perturbatively meaningful, it is too big, despite the fact that we think of strings as too small in the accelerator physics. In the context of Planck physics, it's too big when the string perturbation is valid to see the quantum foam. So when we talk about Planck scale, it's much, much smaller than the string scale. So the fact that string theory has not seen the Planck scale so well is not a criticism of string theory, because strings are too big, it's too coarse an object to see something going on at such a small scale, the quantum scale of the gravity. And whenever you try to probe that scale, whenever you get to the quantum Planck scale, the string perturbation, the coupling constant of string theory has been adjusted so much that string perturbation is not valid anymore. So precisely when you try to ask a question, what is going on at Planck scale, from the string context, string perturbation breaks down. So it's consistent that string theory could live well with a quantum theory of gravity with a foam-like structure at Planck scale. So it modifies, string theory modifies the classical geometry to what's called a stringy geometry. An example of it was mentioned with Ned's talk called mirror symmetry. So it gives you a new geometry, but that new geometry is still smooth, surprisingly. So it replaces a classical geometry with a stringy smooth geometry. And it may be hard to believe that there is a quantum foam description in string theory, that a bumpy quantum foam at the Planck scale is somehow averages out magically to give us this smooth geometry that we talk about as an emergent space-time. However, precisely this has happened recently. In a simplified class of string theories, which is called topological string theories, it has been recently shown that string theory is consistent with a quantum foam picture, at least to all orders in string perturbation theory. So not only space-time, and amazing from this comes out, the space-time form of a crystal becomes an exact corresponding description of a space-time form of physical space-time in this topological string context. So I will give you a brief review of what has happened here, is that in these simplified class of models, a three-dimensional complex geometry of Calabi-Yau threefold can be mapped to the geometry of a corner of a room. So string theory modifies the corner of a room from looking like a corner to something which looks like basically, it's still a corner of a room, but some pieces of it chopped off. Still smooth geometry. An analogy is like melting of the surface of a crystal. You start with a crystal, and the boundary of it is like a corner of a room, and somehow the boundary melts away. And so macroscopic crystal geometry looks like this macroscopic stringy geometry. And it's natural to ask, what about the atomic structure of crystal? What is that in stringy geometry? And a simple model for the surface melting of crystal is as removing atoms, starting from the atoms near the corner, or if you wish, piling up boxes at the corner of a room, whichever way you wish to think about. And it turns out that each molten configuration of the crystal corresponds to a unique geometry of space. Each small face of the molten crystal corresponds to a bubble of space-time foam, which is what mathematicians have studied well, and it's called the blow-up of a point. So you can map the configuration space of the boundary of a surface melting to actual geometry, a non-trivial Calabi-Yau geometry involving non-trivial blow-ups of space and time, of space, Calabi-Yau space. So each atom of the crystal corresponds to a blow-up of a space-time bubble, and the distance between these lattice points is in fact the Planck scale, the Planck length. So a typical configuration of the molten crystal at large T will give you some average shape, which indeed looks like the average shape that I was drawing for you, that string sees, string perturbation sees, this average thing. But at the Planck scale, it's very bumpy. And then string theory basically misses seeing this, but it's perfectly consistent with this description. And so it's ironic that we have started with the crystals as made of atoms and elementary particles, and those being made of strings, and strings made of atomic crystal space. Space-time foam. Is quite ironic that this has repeated itself, and it's natural to expect that string theory will, the notion of quantum foam will extend to the full superstring, that we can have a quantum foam description of the full superstring theory. Thank you.
And let's thank all the panel speakers, and thank everybody from this morning's session.